We are Two Guys Gaming. As always, even though the music says Two Guys Gaming, this is One Guy Reading. Whether you meant to or not, you found Noob's Book Club. I'm Sean, noob of all trades from Two Generations Gaming, and in this particular series, I am reading and reacting to The Burning God, the third and final book in the Poppy Warrior series by R.F. Kuang. This is going to be the last episode of this particular series for right now. I'm going to take a break for the rest of March and deal with Project Hail Mary, because the movie is coming out this month, so I wanted to do a special movie versus. And then in April, I will get back to finishing up this series, then I will do the movie versus for Jurassic Park, and in May, I plan on doing Red Mars, starting the Red Mars series. So that's where we're going in the next couple of months. As I always do in this series, I will first read the summary for the section. I am currently doing part 2, chapters 11 through 16 for this particular episode, and then I will give my thoughts. This time around, I'm going to give my thoughts in the context of four ideas that popped into my head, how they relate to my life, and how they relate back to the book. Then I'll do the outro, and we'll be done with The Burning God for a month or so, but we will come back in April. I think that's it for introduction. Let's get to the summary from supersummary.com. They do not support me. I simply like what they do, so I use them for the summaries now. Part 2, Chapter 11, Summary. Daji, fear of Riga's unpredictability, watches through a spyglass as a genocide unfolds on Spear. Zhang, who loved the Spearly general Hanalei, is angry at Riga. Riga has used fear to control Daji and Zhang since they were children. Zhang and Riga start fighting with their powers. Fearing destruction, Daji puts a seal on all three of them. Part 2, Chapter 12. This chapter is a memorandum written about Nakan by Hesperian Major General Joseph Tarquette. He details Nakara mining deposits and goods. He describes the Grey Company's difficulty in converting people to Makerism. He reports that Vaisra has overthrown the remnants of Dazi's empire and that the Republic is weak and manipulatable. He says their greatest threat from the South's quote-unquote indigenous guerrilla movements led by Rin. She and Nisha are the only shamans Hesperia knows about, and they've been conducting research on Nisha to find out how to defeat Rin. Once she falls, they predict the South will fall. Part 2, Chapter 13, Summary. Rin wakes up in a dirigible with Daji, who explains they're going to Chulukurik to free Zhang. A journey that would normally have taken weeks takes less than a day. Republican soldiers carry Rin inside the mountain. She panics as she realizes Daji means to inter her. She's enclosed in a stony plinth, which feels like drowning and being unable to die. She thinks over past memories and talks to the specter of Altan in her mind. He berates her for her weakness, for wasting the opportunity she's been given while commanding the Southern Army, and for loving Nisha. Zhang breaks Rin's plinth. With Zhang free, both he and Daji look younger and more powerful. As they make dinner, they catch Zhang up on Kate's kidnapping and the country's political situation. Zhang wants her to kill Gurubai and Suji and take control of the Southern Army. Daji says that being hated, as the trifecta was, isn't detrimental as long as they become entrenched in the mythos of the country. She encourages Rin to cultivate a larger-than-life image among the public. Daji says they'll find Kate, then wake Riga. Part 2, Chapter 14, Summary. Rin, Zhang, and Daji raft to the Republic's headquarters to find Kate. They pass signs of resistance against Vaisra and many slaughtered towns. Daji explains how Hesperia terrorizes people with their dirigibles and that Hesperia's actions led the trifecta to become shamans. Rin is worried about the changes she perceives in Zhang's character as the trifecta's seals erode. He refers to the quote-unquote gatekeeper as if he's a separate person and says he experiences his memories as if living them for the first time. They disguise themselves as refugees and enter New City's walls. Inside, Rin sees electricity, miniature parcel delivery dirigibles, and a steam-powered transportation for the first time. Rin carves the word, quote-unquote, where, into her skin for Kate, who will feel it because of their bond. While they wait for his response, they explore the city. Rin reckons with the quote-unquote soft erasure of her culture being expunged compared to the quote-unquote hard erasure of military might and death. She's shocked by the Nakara, who seem pleased by their new neighbors. Kate writes back, at his coordinates, they find a church. Part 2, Chapter 15, Summary. They entered the church as congregants. Rin sneaks off to the basement, which is being used as a prison. She finds Kate and starts to free him, but hides when they hear a noise. It's Nisha. Kate asks him about being experimented on by the Grey Company. They discuss Nisha's frustrations. Rin is jealous of Kate's ability to speak to him as a friend. Kate and Nisha both acknowledge that neither the Hesperians nor Nakara generals believe in Nisha. Tarket in particular brings his racist stereotypes into their interactions. Kate refuses to work for Nisha as a strategist. Nisha wants them to be a team again. Kate has qualms with Nisha bombing civilians. He fears that if he and Rin join Nisha, they'll be disposable again, like they were the first time. Once Nisha leaves, Kate tells Rin he's visited him every day. They escape the city in a laundry cart, and Daji and Jiang fly Kate for information. They decide to go to Dog Province before Vaisra can attack them. Zhang is sure he can break Vaisra's blockade and enlist the help of the Southern Army before going north. Alone, Kate confesses that all the technological marvels he saw in New City made him wonder if Hesperians really were an Aitlu superior. He thinks their scientific marvels, quote, rewrite the script of the world, end quote, in the same way that Rin's powers do, but without needing to, quote, sacrifice their sanity, end quote. Rin thinks that Daji and Zhang's plan to march the army north to Dog Province through Mount Tian Shan means the Dragon Emperor Yen Riga is there, and they are meant to free him, uniting the trifecta. Part 2, Chapter 16, Summary. Rin and Kate sneak into the Southern Coalition's forces in the Baolei Mountains. Venka helps them prepare the Southerners to flee. Starving and unhappy with Suji and Guobai's leadership, they are ready to leave. Their exodus lines up with Vaser's arrival at the front to see his troops. As the Southerners flee to the underground mines, Zhang opens the gates to the Emperor's Menagerie, and the loosened spirits take down 5 dirigibles and the ground forces. Rin sees a dirigible fleeing, and Zhang makes it crash. Inside the wreckage, Rin finds an injured Vaisra. She breathes flame into his body via his mouth. A dirigible cannon knocks out Zhang. Rin and Daji carry him to safety while he hallucinates. Well, a lot happening here. We are in the thick of it with this one, and I am leaving you at quite the cliffhanger now to move on to the next book, but worry not. We will get back in April to finish this one off. Okay. Now for my thoughts. The first thought I had was the old power corrupts. Absolute power corrupts, absolutely. I heard this in middle school history class once. Real, I'm 14 and this is deep vibes, right? But it stayed with me and proves itself time and again. In the world around us, they keep handing power to these mad kings, and they continue to push for more. The same douchebags who called everyone else cucks now prostrate themselves in front of Donald Trump. And for what? To own the libs? Make those with bright colored hair upset or angry? Cutting off multiple body parts despite people who simply are trying to live. I simply don't understand the point to any of it. So now let's try to analyze the book in this context instead. What happens when the absolute power is not simply earthly power? When you have the power of literal gods at your fingertips, is there any way to fight that power? Is Rin doomed to succumb to that power? Daji gives her the advice to, quote, become above right and wrong, end quote. Taken one way, this gives Rin the license to do whatever she wants, because her decisions are neither right nor wrong. They are, and they write the course of history. When history is written, it's written by the victors, right? Then, and only then, the decisions are judged as right or wrong. It's how a society descends into shared psychosis and justifies the actions in the context of neither right nor wrong, just necessary. Another justification, especially in the context of Western religion, is that God is over right and wrong by always being right. Therefore, when you're on the side of God, you can never be wrong. As such, you can also justify some horrific acts. The difference here is that history often judges you less harshly for these acts. Yes, you get the occasional witch hunt that loses the PR battle, but consider that we still laud crusaders and pioneers and colonials and patriots. The fight against those groups and their atrocities faces way less pushback. Why? Is the need for tribalism that ingrained in us that we forgive those transgressions as necessary to build our great nations? Sadly, it seems so. Now, in the context of Rin, how do we interpret all of this? Is she exerting her influence in the hopes that history remembers her favorably? For some reason, I think not. She, thanks to the Phoenix, Altan, and a broken Katay, she simply wants to burn everything. Human morality be damned. Defeat them, destroy everything. Who cares if it even ever gets sorted out? Rin blew past the warnings of power as a corrupting influence, and Daji finally gave her the green light to use that power without restraint. My second thought, you either die the hero, or you live long enough to become the villain. As far as I know, there's no real-world analog for this phenomenon. Sure, you hear it all the time. Maybe you mostly just read it. Because honestly, the only place I've ever seen it unironically is online. So yeah, it makes sense in that context that it doesn't work that way in real life. No matter how much the chuds want to make their bullshit online rules into real life. With all that said, I thought of something related. I added several new podcasts to my playlist. One of them, This Guy Sucked, has a slogan. It's never too late to get haters, and you can't libel the dead. To me, that illustrates something interesting. With the internet, truly, everything is forever. Even if you existed before the internet, scholars will study you and your life. Because of the internet, they can much more easily collaborate, even if only by reading each other's research. So a lot of these great men of history, parenthetically, dying the hero, in parenthetical, have been quote-unquote alive long enough to end up as the villain. Not strictly related, maybe, but I thought an interesting revelation. Also, I suppose it could be argued that it is an example of the chuds invading real life. Maybe in a good way. Okay, that sounds like a value judgment. Moving on. In the context of this work of fiction, it follows the arc perfectly. While you may argue against Rin ever actually being the hero, she certainly became a villain. Several times over, if we are being honest. I can't even take solace in a redemption arc anymore. I gave up that hope long ago. At this point, all I could do is watch helplessly as she descends ever further into becoming the worst of humanity. In that regard, Kitei and I have much in common. It's frustrating watching someone you care about losing their humanity. I don't necessarily care about Rin, but I do admire Kitei, and I mourn for him losing Rin. Third thought, all or nothing versus compromise. I've been thinking about this one and ideas like it for a while now. It started with the thought that people often fall into one of two groups. They either see the key to our success as cooperation or competition. I always fell, and still do, into the first camp. The reason that humans survived as long as they did and rose to become the dominant species is our ability to work together. We work together to build great civilizations, societies that can easily meet every person's want and needs. Unfortunately, we continually put people in charge who are damn sociopaths. Some argue it's the system that rewards sociopathic behavior, but we continue to allow the system to exploit and perpetuate Every time I think we might be close to turning the tide, nothing. And yet, I hold out hope that the next time will be different. Is it any wonder they call me insane? I know why, I get that recent evidence goes against me. I'm watching the same things as everyone else. While we still deal with the quiet, parenthetically for now, slash creeping horrors at home, and parenthetical, we also face the loud and boastful incompetence of the war in Iran. I don't blame people for falling into despair. Mr. Rogers supposedly said, quote, look for the helpers, end quote. You can't believe anything these days. However, someone said it, whoever they are, it's good advice. And it's advice that I'm taking to heart. The way the bastards win is through division. It's all they have to offer. Our greatest strength is us. That strength, frankly, scares them. This is all coming to bear some fruits. While people argue, quote, what good are whistles, end quote, we understand that those are a distraction to allow neighbors to visit neighbors, checking in, delivering groceries, planning and executing other activities to lift the community and ensure the safety of their neighbors. Keep saying hello to your neighbors. It won't always work. One of our neighbors snow blows the walks. He stops right at our property line. I don't know why he does that, but we've talked about it and can't help but think that it's personal. Nevertheless, put yourself out there. If it does lead to something, use that to offer your help. Ask if they need anything at the store when you visit. Maybe build a community kitchen or a little library. Eventually, that might lead to more neighbors helping neighbors, and then who knows? My dream is always small block or community gatherings. This line of thinking naturally leads to the theme as discussed in the book. Is the world zero sum, or is there room for compromise? Kwong shows us the potential downfalls of both. Rin believes in all or nothing. Anything short of total victory is defeat. That line of thinking inevitably leads ultimately to ruin. It's simply not a sustainable way to build a society and is ultimately doomed to fail. Nisha, however, compromises. Unfortunately, he takes it to the extreme. When you prioritize compromise over everything, it becomes capitulation. So as with most things, it seems like the actual way forward lies somewhere in the middle. Do no harm, but take no shit. I'm learning this more and more as time goes on. Students will often tell me that I'm quote-unquote too nice. I never understood what that means. Hell, I never understand how that is possible, but I know now. It is not a reflection on me, but on them. They think because of my calm nature and flexibility that they can take advantage of me. Well, fuck that. Do no harm, but take no shit. Colonialism. Okay. Oh boy. This is a big one. I'm not even 100% sure what I meant by this one. I mean, we face the specter even today. These quote-unquote wars that our government keep waging, they're wars of conquest. They tell us openly that they hope to return to the sphere of influence model of world politics. It's all just so stupid. And now, with this book, I can't even escape it. Because it's an allegory for Chinese and Japanese politics, the characters face the crush of a colonial power. I mean, I knew this was going to be dark, but I underestimated just how much. The promise of high fantasy hooked me. Don't get me wrong, I do love the books. They're just so much right now. I mean, in addition to the war in Iran and the coup in Venezuela, we're also currently starving the Cuban people with an unnamed embargo. And that's just what they're making public. Who knows what other bullshit these maniacs are hiding behind the shadows? When people say this isn't who we are, they obviously don't know history. This is always who we've been. A nation started on genocide and built on the backs of slaves. People who never reckoned with these actions and simply expected everyone to quote-unquote get over it. And yes, these are the same people who cry, never forget 9/11 and now October 7th. And use them to perpetrate more violence. I said it the other day. I wish we weren't repeating all of history's mistakes at once. I don't ever pretend to have the answers. And you shouldn't believe anyone who says that they do. These are complicated issues, made more so by trying to solve them as if they can be solved without years of discussion, compromise, parenthetically, there's that word again, and parenthetical, and actual deals. Not the nonsense posturing of the supposed strong man in charge. Some fiction is an escape from reality. These books are a reminder that there's still so much left to do. The issue is that progress takes so long, is so easily undone, and now I fear that we may truly be out of time. I hate to be so gloomy, and I know things have been bad before. I was talking about it yesterday. We saw a problem in the ozone, and we worked to help reverse it. The problem I see now is that the pendulum seems to have swung so much that there aren't enough people who want or even understand how. As always, though, I pray that I'm wrong in that regard. So, as I said after the summary, quite a bit going on here. It's got my brain rattled, along with, as I mentioned the last time, Grave of the Fireflies, and everything that's currently happening in real life. I need to step away from this book for a little bit and fill my life with some hope. And as I said earlier, that escape of Project Hail Mary, which I will do 4 episodes on, and then I will do a movie versus, and then I'll do a final 3 episodes on this one, movie versus for Jurassic Park, and then I will do Red Mars. All of this might change with the release, supposed release of the new Dragonlance book this year, but I will put all that in the show notes if and when that happens, and I will also make an announcement on this show. I think that's it. Time for the outro. As always, thanks for listening. You can find us, if you haven't already yet, www.twoguysgaming.net. We have articles. I've been doing articles on Season 2 of the Fallout show, which is getting really good. And it's not quite such a downer as this one. There's enough humor in it to keep me from completely losing my mind at everything that's happening. Oh, I also did a silly article where I interviewed one of history's greatest killers, the first Goomba from Mario Brothers. I'm pretty proud of that article. I think it's funny. You should definitely check it out if you get a chance. The page also leads to our socials, our YouTube, which is extremely active right now compared to where it was. I am going to do a deep dive on my favorite hidden gem for Nintendo, Kiko Cubicle. I'm also going to do a quick video for my Ready Player One playthrough to introduce my character who's going into the Tomb of Horrors. There's also a link to our TikTok, which is less active than it's been in the past, but I still try to post at least once a week, if not multiple times. I will be back next time with the first episode for Project Hail Mary, and I will talk to you then. Bye, guys.
We are Two Guys Gaming.